Hello, you're listening to Flix West Canada, and I'm here today with Matthias van der Roost, and we're going to talk about La Haine. That's all the pronunciation I'm going to get right for the rest of this episode. It's a little over 20 years now. I think it came out 95, so it's about 23 years old, but I think it's a film that's still relevant. Maybe I should summarize it, and feel free to jump in if I'm going to mess anything up.
Sure.
But it's basically about three friends, Vince, Hubert, and Said, who are all played by actors with the same names, Vincent.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty
Hubert,
cool.
Said. Yeah. it's interesting. And it's just after a big riot, the group of friends, one of their friends had been injured by police. He's in police custody in a hospital. And one of them, Vince, who's played by Vincent Cassel, he had stolen a gun from the cop during the riot.
Did he steal it or did he find it? I kind of got the impression that the cop lost his gun in a scuffle or something, and then later he just kind of found it somewhere, you know?
That's a good point. I don't think they actually say he stole it. He makes a big deal out of it, like,
sure.
Look, I have a gun, but he probably did just find it, like you said. But I sort of tied a little bit to, like, some of these crime stories, like Stray Dog, the Kurosawa film, or, like, it just reminded me of that, the sort of lost gun, stolen gun storyline you see once in a while. But he talks a lot about maybe shooting a cop if their friend dies.
Right.
And the film, over the next day, they're sort of going about their business, scuffling with cops. They make a trip from the projects into Paris with basically no money. They go to collect one of their friend's debts. His nickname's Asterix.
Oh, so that was the same in your version. Because I read that in some versions, in some territories, because they don't know the comic book that name comes from or refers to, they changed it in some versions, but you had the same one then.
Right. I wonder what they changed it to.
I don't know.
I guess not everyone knows Asterix and Obelix. But,
they're huge here. Yeah.
But I don't know in North America how popular they are. They might not be that well known. Anyway, two of them get caught by cops, sort of beat up, interrogated, while one of them, Vince, goes off and sees a bunch of movies. Then they meet up like nothing happened.
Right.
They take a bus back into the projects. Oh, I just skipped a big
Well,
big
the
thing
art gallery as well. And then they tried to
the art gallery
car,
episode.
And then, yeah.
Right. And, well, a big turning point is when they run into the other gang, the sort of skinhead gang, and they take one of them and Vince. This is after the friend dies. I'm messing up all the plot.
Actually, I used to think they were skinheads as well. And then in the commentary track, Kasovic says that actually they're skinhead hunters instead of skinheads, which makes no sense because they look exactly like you would expect skinheads.
Yeah, they have all the shaped heads, and you think they're picking a fight with, you know, Arab, Jew,
right.
And African. Like, it's... Yeah, like, I assume they were skinheads, so
right.
I don't know if it's, like, one of those things where you have, like, anti-fascists or
right.
basically just fascists
right.
or what that situation is. But
well, and it was also kind of provoked by Said, because in an earlier scene on the roof, he yells something at them, and so it kind of came because of that, and then later they run into each other on the street level, but before that, he had kind of called them some names from the rooftop.
Right, they said, you're the guys from the roof.
Right,
so that's why they get into the scuffle. And Vince, he threatens to shoot one of them, but he proves that he's just all talk. He lets him go. Because, like, Vince, he's the one that kind of brags the most. He's always sort of exaggerating. I like, at one point, when they're trying to steal the car, they realize nobody knows how to drive.
Right.
They said, didn't you drive that woman around in a Ferrari in Israel? Like, this sort of outlandish story. And he goes, oh, no, that was an automatic car.
Right.
But, you know, you get the impression he's always sort of talking big. So, like, it turns out he doesn't really have it in him to kill someone, even though they find out from the news that their friend died. One of the first things they do after they see that news report is run out to see where he is, and he's just he's pointing his fingers like a gun at the cops, right. But he doesn't actually shoot one like they were worried. And back in the projects, he gives the gun to Hubert, basically, you know,
right,
hang on to this. And then he gets caught by the cops, and cop's gun goes off and shoots Vince. And then the film sort of ends with Hubert and the cop pointing a gun at each other, right. And Saeed looking in horror.
Right.
So that's roughly, I jumped around a lot, but that's kind of the plot. Okay.
The fact that none of them know how to drive was one of the things that made me wonder, how old do you think these guys are? Like, are they maybe like teenagers, or like, are they a little bit older? I wasn't quite sure how old they're supposed to be.
I got the impression that they're teenagers. I think the actors might be a little bit older than the parts they're playing. That's sort of
right, like Grease.
Common. Yeah, a bit like Grease. But, you know, it seems like, you know, they're still living at home. They're still either with their parents or grandparents. You know, they act like teenagers still, maybe right. 18, 19. I figured they were meant to be around that age. I don't know if, like, they might be out of high school and not going into higher education or...
Yeah.
I think Hubert's helping his younger sister study. So, right. You know, and he talks about getting out of the projects. Yeah.
Right. I had the impression that he wasn't really able to help her. Like, probably, like, they're probably dropouts to a degree.
Right.
Like, they probably left school.
Yeah, it seems
and,
that way.
Right. So, you know, the fact that they kind of live at home still, I'm not sure if that means they're young or, like, they just can't afford to move anywhere. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, one thing you sort of get a sense of is that they have very little money. They're always kind of scrounging together, or like, one of the things that's funny about the whole art gallery episode is they basically just go to get the free snacks, you know. I like when Saeed right. just gets offered the champagne by the server, and he's so happy when he takes it, and the other two try to get in on that. But right. I mean, that's something I used to do as a student, is go to the art openings and get the free
oh, really?
Cheese and grapes and crackers. So I totally got that part of it. Or even the fact that, you know, they're going through all this trouble to try and get money from the Asterix character who comes across a little bit crazy, I guess.
Right.
And it ends up only being for like 500 francs or something like that.
Right. Well, actually, I just looked it up. In some versions, he's called Snoopy instead of Asterix. But
okay.
The thing about the art gallery thing is that the older guy that kind of leads them away at the end of that is actually Kasovic's father. And I saw that he was in a Godard film, actually, My Life to Live. He's in that, apparently. So that was kind of funny.
Kasovic mentioned, like, his father was a television director. Right. I don't know if I've seen anything he would have done, but...
Right. But he was an actor as well, apparently.
But I guess he was an actor as well. He's actually good in that part. He comes across very friendly, I guess.
Well, that was one of the things he mentioned on the commentary, was that he kind of wanted to basically confront his dad, who was kind of like one of those guys who's, he considers himself very left-leaning, but he's also got these prejudices about these young guys, and that's kind of the role he plays as well. So I thought that was kind of funny that he used a lot of people that he knew, like the producer is the cabbie. And then he also has the costume designer on the train as the lady who's begging. And then he also has, in that same scene, the guy with the headphones was actually the sound designer, which I thought was kind of funny. He was literally listening to the audio as it was being recorded. So, I like little things like that where, you know, they sneak people in that that are involved.
I mean, that's also like a staple of lower-budget filmmaking.
Right.
You know, you kind of sneak the crew into the film because... they're there that day.
Right.
They're usually happy to have like a little part, you know, they can point out to their friends, say it's me. And like, it usually doesn't cost you anything extra if you're clever about it. So, you know, it's not unusual to see people who are pulling double duty in the low budget films. And there's a few things, like, I thought it was interesting, like in the commentary, he talks about, you know, some of the ways they saved money, or some of the ways he spent money. Like, there's that one helicopter shot. Oh, yeah. I guess it was like an early drone shot. He mentions he had to make quite a few sacrifices to get it, and right. it basically didn't turn out quite the way he had hoped. It's a beautiful shot. It's when the DJ is playing
right.
music on his speakers out the window, and the camera kind of drifts over, and I guess he wanted it to drift all the way over to the main group, but it didn't quite make it, and he had to digitally erase a helicopter shadow. So
oh, yeah.
that ended up being one of those things that I don't know if he thought maybe it was worth it, even though it looks interesting.
Right. Well, actually, speaking of the DJ in that, and I know that you tweeted, I think last night, that your friend thought that the film was kind of derivative of Spike Lee, was it? And I felt that
yep.
the DJ was one of those things. He's kind of like the Samuel L. Jackson character in Do the Right Thing. Like, he's that sort of neighborhood guy.
Right. It's a little bit like the chorus of the projects, or
right.
the fact that you can hear it all the way out across, you know, it sort of sets the mood of the whole place. And I think it's very interesting, the combination of hip-hop with the Edith Piaf.
Right.
One impression I get from the characters in the projects, I keep calling it the projects, I think the actual name is Chanteloup.
Right.
But they're much more, it seems, global, diverse than the people in Paris. You know, they're not necessarily that tied to what people think of as French
right.
culture.
Well, I think that's also because many of them are not ethnically French, per se.
Yes.
So,
yeah. And, like, they have, you know, Spider-Man t-shirt, they listen to American music parts, you know, they're not nationalistic at all.
Well, that's also because a lot of the people that are ethnically French keep sort of pushing this idea that they're not French enough, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So there's a lot of exclusion towards them, and then that makes them not want to really participate in anything that's considered French.
I think it's an important part of the film, actually, is that gap where these people are not, you know, they don't feel particularly French. You know, I think they're probably all actually born in France, you know.
Yeah. Or,
you know, there are French citizens. I mean, there was the article that The Guardian did
right.
for the 20th anniversary of the film. I thought it was very interesting when they point out the giant faces on the buildings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the artwork of, I forget who it was exactly.
I know Baudelaire was one of them, and then
Rimbaud,
more.
Or,
oh, yeah.
You know, there were people like that, you know, just like these giant, they called them Orwellian faces,
right.
sort of something that maybe the intent was to sort of be like a friendly kind of cultural outreach, instead has this sort of implication of some dominating cultural force being
right.
quite intimidating.
Well, literally looking down on them.
For sure.
It's very symbolic.
And that was really there. It's not an invention of the film, you know,
right.
so it has that symbolic quality, but it's not, you know, that's symbolism in real life. The film didn't have to come up with that.
It's kind of funny because on my way to work, I always pass a building and it has similar faces on it. And, but that's mostly because the person was born in that neighborhood, I think.
Right.
But I was reminded of that, like, oh, it's a, you know, a face on a building somewhere, and, you know.
Right. I think, like, a lot of European countries have sort of, you know, equivalents to this Chanteloup. Like, we were talking on Twitter a little while ago about the Belmemir.
Oh, I was going to bring that up when
right.
you mentioned that. I was like, oh, because that's our version of that in a way, where, yeah, it's a lot of people from, you know, with parents or grandparents from other countries. And, it, you know, it's near Amsterdam, or I think it's part of Amsterdam, actually. But
I think there's equivalents to what you're seeing in
right.
the film in other places. They don't necessarily all have the same kind of civil unrest. But, you know, I think it's not necessarily that specifically French what you're seeing in the film. I mean, I think in the commentary, Kassovitz says, like, oh, French like to have revolutions. We're like a revolutionary people or something like that, he says, you know. And I think there's a little bit of that sentiment with the constant rioting, or, you know, the riots you see at the beginning of the film. Like, that's, again, not created for the film. That's real footage that was incorporated into it. So there's sort of, you know, maybe a particular tendency towards civil unrest. I don't know, not to generalize or... how do I segue out of this?
I don't know. But yeah, as far as we talked about Do the Right Thing a little bit, you know, of course, mm-hmm. Vince has those rings with his name on them. That's, yeah. I felt like, a pretty obvious reference. And then also, there's a couple of moments where he does that thing that Spike Lee does a lot, where it's like the really quick zooming of the camera while it kind of goes... I think the camera goes backwards, but it's zooming in, so it has this really weird effect.
A lot of the kind of quick punch-in camera movements are very Spike Lee, or when you see Wilbert for the first time boxing, and it's in that slow motion, like that looks like something you'd see out of Do the Right Thing, or... like, I think Gasovets kind of wears his influences on his sleeve, and a lot of them are American influences, probably... most of them in the film that you see, you know, there's very obvious allusions to Scorsese.
Scarface, of course, the big poster that you see twice.
For sure. The world is yours. The world is ours.
Right. I like that he changes it. Yeah. I thought that was nice. But actually, as far as that, the way that it's shot goes, especially when they get to the city, there's mm-hmm. that sort of introduction. And speaking of that, I really wondered what it meant for the Eiffel Tower to go dark. Like, I wonder what that was about. Because he didn't explain that. He did explain the cow, but he didn't explain the Eiffel Tower going dark.
I'm not positive. I assume that it goes dark at a certain time at night.
Oh, so
maybe
it's
early
a
in the morning. I assume it was a standard thing. So he was trying to time it so that when he, you know, clicked his fingers, it would turn off at that exact moment. And I think it was just meant to show that only happens in the movies. They say it doesn't quite happen when he wants, but it still happens. You know, there's a lot of little touches that I think maybe show that these characters are not going to get what they want. You know, things aren't going to turn out for them like they do in the movies. Okay. That's maybe one way of looking at it. I don't know. That's not especially deep reading, but there's like a few episodes in the film which seem to be in there more for
like
allegorical
meanings.
Significance or texture. Yeah, like, you know, I was sort of wondering about the significance of the cow, because I thought when I first saw it, I thought, oh, like, it just shows how urbanized they are, that, oh, look, a cow.
I thought it was like sort of a dream thing, like it wasn't real at first, because Vince is the only one who sees it.
You know, he's high, or, but like in the commentary, I guess, because of it said Vash, a cow, it's like slang for a cop. So like that's one thing I didn't pick up on at all.
Well, he also mentioned that this neighborhood is, because it's so far, I think it was like 45 minutes from Paris by train. And I think that he said something like, it's basically in the countryside, but it's this, you know, it's like a city on its own. So it's not that strange. Actually, now I'm remembering, he mentioned that when they first got there, because they lived in the city for a while before they started shooting, like the first day he got there, there was some circus there. And so there were all these weird animals, like camels and stuff, walking through this neighborhood. And I think that's where it came from. Now I remember.
It's funny.
I just remembered that.
On the podcast a little while ago, we did an episode of Neil Jordan. It made me think of the ending of The Miracle a bit, where you have these animals kind of wandering where they shouldn't be. But, you know, there's images like that where it seems like, you know, maybe there's some significance to them, or is it just adding texture to the film? It's hard to pin down exactly what the significance might be. You know, one thing I sort of wondered about was the man in the bathroom who comes out.
Right.
And he has this story. I sort of think it's like the parable of Grunwalski, his friend who got off the train to Siberia to relieve himself and ended up not being able to make it back on the train on time because his pants were falling down and he'd freeze to death. You know, it's hard to say. Even the characters themselves sort of say, why did he say that to us? You know, so I sort of wondered what that was doing in the film, if it's just sort of an omen, or I don't know what you think.
Well, I think in the commentary, we talk about the commentary a lot, actually, but Kasovic, I think, said that it's kind of his way of, I'm guessing he heard them talk in the bathroom, and then he was like, you know, you think you have it bad, really? Like, you know, my friend died while trying to take a dump, you know, on our way to concentration camp, so it could be worse. I think that that was the point. One other weird thing about that scene is that there's a phone in the bathroom, which seemed kind of odd.
That is weird.
Yeah. But I thought maybe I'm not seeing it correctly because there is a lot of mirrors going on, so not everything you see is in the place that you think it is. So I thought maybe that's actually outside of the bathroom. Maybe he's not in the place that I think he's in. But
it's hard to tell. I thought it was like it's the sort of like mirror against the wall where you wash your hands. But I don't know. It's hard to tell. Like you said, I mean, it's interesting. Like that the story maybe having this importance. Like you know, we actually had it really hard, you know, like, again, and you know, the hate, the anger kind of coming from things outside of your actual life or outside your control, or, you know, the idea even of a generational hate, you know, if his parents or grandparents had it hard, you know, and he might not actually have it that bad, but he still might carry that with him. I think Kasovitz is trying to show that a little bit with these characters.
Well, I wonder also where Vince's parents are, because I think he lives with his grandma, doesn't he?
I think so, because isn't his sister who comes in who says, like, I'm going to tell grandma on you, you're going to get high. And then they start making fun of her, ma mère, or, you know.
Right. Well, and also in a later scene, they run into Saeed's little sister, and she's and he kind of scolds her for being in public, and she should be in school, and that whole kind of thing. They're not, you know, practicing what they preach, because they probably still should be in school, although they might be old enough to not have to go to school. I'm not sure, but, you know.
Right. I mean, that's something you see a lot of the time is people who maybe made certain choices that put them in a bad place, not wanting their little siblings to go in that same direction. You know, you still try to look out for your younger siblings, even if you might be going out at night and getting into trouble, you know, maybe especially because you know what kind of trouble's out there. So that's why they all seem like a little bit protective of their younger siblings. They all have younger siblings, I guess.
Yeah, they all have one younger sister. Although I think Vince may have more siblings, but there's only the one sister he talks to. But I think at the table when he's having breakfast, I think there are more kids there, but I'm not sure. They might be cousins or I don't know.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that it all takes place in, you know, only one day, really. I do like that when it's a very sort of short span, and just seeing how much you can learn about these characters in a very short period of time, really. I think that's always kind of nice in films.
Yeah, the one day in the life kind of format that I usually like as well. I think I prefer that over films that take place over years and years and span generations sometimes. You know, I think I like stories that take place over a shorter period of time. You know, you can kind of tell everything you need to usually. And in this case, it's less a slice of life and more like this is how it's going to end for most of these characters.
Yeah.
You know, since Vince ends up dead, and then, like, it probably implies that Hubert ends up dead. Maybe Saeed might get out of there alive, but, you know, the ending sort of, it's not that optimistic. They have this idea of the society in free fall.
Right.
You have the phrase at the beginning and at the end, the little story about falling and saying, well, so far so good, so right. far so good. But it's not the falling, it's the landing that's lethal.
Right, because isn't there, at the start of the film, that's sort of an explosion, like something hitting the floor, and then I think that was part of
that. Yeah, it's like, I think it was like a puddle of water, but it looks it's in it looks like the globe, I thought. So it's like, I don't know, sort of visual representation of the world getting splashed, you know. So I think it shows it in specific by relating it to these three characters, but it's that idea that, we don't actually have a problem, everything's fine, but you're actually in free fall and you're about to crash and things might get very bad.
Right, and of course there's always that sort of, it's always more comfortable to ignore certain problems than to actually do something about it, so I think, you know, that's part of what the film is about, really, is the, you know, the fact that these communities exist, and, you know, the relationship there between them and the cops and everything, you know, it's not exactly going well.
How do you feel about the depiction of the cops in the film?
I think it's always hard to judge whether it's realistic or not, because, you know, if you're not from a place like that, but I do think that, there are those countries where, you know, the cops that go into areas like that, it's more like military than cops, you know what I mean? And that was actually when they went to Paris, the first cop that they meet is all of a sudden very nice, you know? Like, it's a very different kind of cop as opposed to where they live. So I thought that was interesting.
That's one of my favorite details in the film, actually, is just that immediate contrast between how the cops behave out in the projects and how they behave in Paris, you know, good evening, gentlemen, or something like that. Right. You know, he's very polite, friendly cop, you know, he has no reason to think they're up to no good. And Kasavitz talked a little bit about the problem of sending police with very little training into these projects where there's sort of a presumption that everyone's up to something, up to no good, and you know, sort of responding with violence a lot of the time, that kind of police mentality of, you know, if you have a hammer, every problem starts to look like a nail,
right?
Maybe playing a role in escalating certain situations. Like, one impression I get from the film is that in the projects, there's like this tendency to escalate situations. You know, I think it's sort of funny when they go to the art gallery. And by escalate, I mean like both cops and the people there, you know, they get used to these sort of escalations. So like when they go to the art gallery and they start flirting with the woman and her friends kind of butting in, like it's sort of interesting just how quickly the three guys escalate. And they kind of take it into like this very sort of loud argumentative territory very quickly. You know, it's not the kind of, I don't know, sort of behavior you might expect to see from people maybe in the city. I think that's part of what it's trying to show. Like, you know, everyone at the art gallery seems like kind of shocked how loud they get and how sort of argumentative they get.
When he comes in, he kind of ruins it right away, but because he's, you know, he said that, oh, you know, he's this kind of a shy type, and then he comes in and he, you know, he tries to show off, I guess, in front of his friends, and it kind of ruins the whole thing when
he comes in with that swagger and
he probably could have gotten a better result out of the situation, but, you know, and I think actually all three of them probably are bragging a lot about things they didn't do, when they're in the park and Saeed is trying to tell this story about how he had sex with some woman. It's like, really? Did you? Like, I'm not buying
it. I think
that.
They say, like, in your dreams. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think you're right. Like, they're probably not actually that good at talking to women, it seems like, you know, from what you see. Which, again, like, kind of gives the impression that they're maybe teenagers still or a little bit younger. You know, they have a lot of bravado, but not much in the way of social skills.
Right, and then also, I wonder who their role models are, because I guess, you know, you don't really see any parents apart from the grandma and then Hubert's mother, but you don't see any men. And then
right.
Saeed has the older brother on the roof, but he seems, I'm not sure what he's involved in, but I think, you know, he might not be, I'm not sure what his business is, you know?
Sure. I mean, if there's like a lack of male role models or male role models who are involved in crime or, you know, whatever
right.
his older brother is involved with, it's probably setting a bad precedent for them.
Well, there is the one cop who probably is from their neighborhood. You know, he seems friendly enough and he seems to try and, you know, keep them out of trouble. Like he wants to protect them and then he gets shot at one point. I'm
right.
not sure why he got shot, what that was about, because there was some sort of a fight and some
yep.
guy in a car was shooting. But I'm not sure whether that was at him specifically or whether he just kind of got involved in the situation. But he did get shot at one point.
Right. I like that there is that kind of constant threat of violence, too. I think even the way the film is structured with those little intercut titles of the time
right.
kind of gives the feeling that, okay, there's maybe a significance to this time. Is something going to is something bad going to happen at 6:01 a.m.? You know,
oh,
it
right,
has
yeah.
that quality where it punctuates the scenes. And I think the film does have a little bit of a loose structure. You know, if people could tell from my rambling plot synopsis, you know, a lot of it kind of feels like three guys hanging out, but there's
right.
definitely like an arc to the journey they go through by the end of the film.
Well, it's hard to summarize
yeah.
the film. Like when you try to explain to people what it's about, it doesn't sound, you know, like it's a great movie. Like I was trying to explain to people last week, like, oh yeah, it's about these three guys and one of them found a gun somewhere and they just kind of hang out and stuff happens. Like that's the best you can do. But when you actually watch it, it, you know, there's a lot going
yeah, 'cause
on.
Like, a lot of it feels, you know, they talk about, like, in screenwriting, your scenes should be, this happens, therefore this happens, not
right.
this happens, and then this happens. But, you know, there is a lot of, and then this happens when you're trying
right.
to describe it. You know, there is some consequence, you know, obviously the friend dying, Abdul dying, you know, gives a reason to maybe provoke Vince to violence, but, you know, he doesn't, ultimately he doesn't kill anyone, you know, but it has sort of a looser structure, you know, a lot of it feels very observational.
Right. yeah, it's like a series of vignettes.
I thought it was funny when after Saeed and Hubert get out of the police custody and Vince had ditched them and gone and
right.
saw a bunch of movies, when he just shows up at the train station and acts like nothing happened.
And then, like, when they get back together, everybody's kind of like, ugh, let's go home, and, like, you know, nothing's happening.
Because he went to that boxing match, and I think he was talking to somebody, and he basically got told off, like,
yeah.
oh, you're always getting into trouble by somebody he knew at the boxing match, so...
Yeah, I forget what happened, but he didn't have too great a time on his own, either. And
no,
but...
it's not fun being alone in the city without
right.
your friends, yeah.
Well, I also wonder how well they actually know the guy who got shot. Like, that was... I kind of got the sense that maybe they're making this... Like, it's one of those things where you feel connected to someone from your town, but you don't necessarily actually know them. But it's almost like a... Like, I'm wondering how well did they actually know him? Because I'm not sure about that.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought too much about it. I assumed he was, you know, the fourth musketeer, I guess.
Okay.
Because when they go to try and see him at the hospital
mm-hmm.
and the cops aren't letting him in, like, Vince especially seems to get really worked up, which, again, I don't know if that's him showing off a little bit.
Up.
Yeah, he always is worked up and trying to show off a bit, you know, and the other two kind of pull him away, but I don't know if maybe Vince was closer to Abdul than maybe the other two were.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he at least seems the most emotional about it, even though it can be hard to tell with him because he is so, you know, Mr. Big Talk, Mr.
Right.
Show Off.
Well,
you know,
and that
but
actually
I did,
makes
yeah.
me makes me think that because he is all talk pretty much, and he doesn't shoot the guy, that makes me wonder about Hubert, who, you know, I get the impression that he's the guy who doesn't say much, but he's actually capable of much more than Vince, which is why I would imagine that when you hear the shot at the end, I would think that it's pretty likely that he did shoot. Or, like, I feel like, is it one shot that you hear, or is it two? Because I would like to think they both shoot. Like, it's an
I rewatched. I think it's two shots at the same time.
Right.
I think they shoot each other. Hubert seems the most serious of the three.
Right.
And Said kind of mitigates the kind of differences between the two of them. And Hubert, I mean, there's moments when he does take action, like when they're trying to run away from the police raid after that great breakdancing scene. You know, they're running off and a cop stands in their way and Vince pulls out the gun and sort of freezes. Hubert says, oh, what are you doing? And he just runs and he punches the cop, and, you know, because he's been training in boxing, he sends the cop flying and they run off, you know. But, like, I don't know. I don't think Vince would have shot that cop. I think he basically froze up in that situation. And Hubert's the one that took action, so...
Right. Well, I also think that it's kind of interesting, because I wonder if they're all the same age. Because I feel like Said is probably a little bit younger than them. Like, and then, like, Hubert is the older guy. Like, they probably know each other from the neighborhood, but not so much like they were in school together or something. Like, it's kind of like when I relate this to when I was young, and, you know, most of the kids I hung out with in my neighborhood, they were not my age necessarily. They were all, like, you know, a year younger or a year older or something like that, and we didn't even go to the same schools, but you kind of hang out because you live, you know, near each other. And I kind of got the impression that that was what was going on with them as well.
No, that could be it. I mean, it seems like they're all within a couple of years,
right?
Like, they're pretty close to being the same age, but you might have, like, Said be a year or two younger, or... I don't know, I didn't check the actual ages of the actors, but if that might be revealing, I'm not sure. It's an interesting relationship that they have, because, like, it can be kind of contentious. You know, they all get along, but... you know, they have distinct personalities, and, like, that's one thing I like about Gasevich's approach to creating the characters, is he didn't make them all uniform. You know, he didn't make them like all three characters as a shorthand for the same idea. You know, he allows it to be this little societal microcosm. You know, you get, like, a full range of ideas and attitudes, you know, just within this little group.
Right, which is why I think this is not necessarily derivative of Do the Right Thing, where I feel like that's much more, you know, like one sort of overarching ideology, where this seems to be more nuanced.
I mean, like, it is a very nuanced film, and it's sort of strange that Kasavitz's career after, like, you never really see that same kind of nuance again, I find. Right. Like, I don't know where it went. Some of it, I wonder even if it's, like, you know, it's easy to attribute things to the director, but I wonder if the fact that he created these characters in collaboration with the actors, if they had input, if that's a part of the reason why they feel so lived in and real. And, you know, he's part of the idea why he wanted the characters' names to be the same as the actors' names is to get them to really invest. And it seems like they did. You know, they feel very, you know, they're all actors. You know, they're all professional actors. You know, they got famous from this film. Vince Cassell especially, you know, he's in big films after, like, Eastern Promises or Elizabeth. But some of the more stylized scenes, like Vince talking to himself in the mirror, and he's basically doing De Niro, but it feels like somebody, like, it's obviously somebody imitating Taxi Driver,
right?
And, like, there's a kind of rawness to these performances that I find adds a lot of weight to it, actually. Like, it doesn't feel too polished.
And also the fact that many of the people from the neighborhood are in the scenes, you know, playing the other characters. So, you know, it's not, you know, like, even if they were very actory, you still have everybody else who isn't. And
right.
Yeah, and speaking of which, the one cop in the Paris scenes, like the older guy, is kind of interesting because he's this rock musician from the band Trust.
Oh, the guy with the long hair?
Yeah, yeah. And he actually, that was the band that had a song on the heavy metal album from the movie from the 80s.
Oh, the movie Heavy Metal.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Wasn't that shot in Toronto somewhere?
Didn't they? Or animated in Canada. Yeah, it's Canadian production. But
right.
I mean, the magazine's French.
Right.
No, that's a funny connection. I didn't realize.
He did mention it in the commentary, I think, because that's why, because this guy had always been sort of very anti, not so much anti-police, but a lot of that band's music apparently is pretty political as well. Mm-hmm. So that's why the other guy assaults the characters at the police station, and he apparently is some sort of a comedic, like some comedian from France, like the guy who... he doesn't really have a name, but he was pretty, like, I was really, you know, hoping that one of them would punch him or something, but of course that wasn't going to happen.
They play such unlikable cops, like,
yeah.
It's definitely on purpose, but it's like, you can tell that those cops, in their own head, they think that they're Dirty Harry, you know, like, right. Oh, I'm the tough cop, I'm going to crack down on these criminal punks, you know, like... Right. It's that quality that makes them so unlikable. I find that they seem like they're, you know, righteous in what they're doing and kind of arrogant, you know.
Right.
I mean, the one thing this movie got flack for is being anti-cop when it came out. Like, I think they said when it screened at Cannes that there were protests. But I think maybe now, today, it's a little bit... It's a little bit easier to... I don't know if it is. Do you think it's easier to criticize cops in films? Or is it still pretty rare? It's hard to say.
Well, there certainly are a lot of films where, you know, you have the dirty cop character in there somewhere. But it's like more of like in an action movie kind of thing. Then no one seems to really be bothered by it. But once it's something where people are supposed to take it seriously, then all of a sudden... People, you know, get very long toes and they're very annoyed and you know, how dare you criticize, you know, the cops and their job is very difficult and who are you to, you know, like you don't, and it's like, well, why are you being so defensive when, you know, like the whole idea is that they're helping people and not doing things to make it worse. And, but then again, also, I think it's, you know, the criticism can be a little unfair because a lot of what they do is determined by politicians at the end of the day. Like, you know, that's who, you know, they decide what the policies are going to be and which kinds of crime are high on the agenda and, you know, all that kind of thing factors into this too. So, you know, you're kind of getting mad at, you know, the people on the, you know, on the floor and not so much people who are actually making these decisions. So, you know...
Right. I mean, the film itself, I think Kasovitz mentioned, it's sort of inspired by real events about the cops shooting somebody while they're in custody, which caused riots. And, like, I think he said those are the part of the riots you see in the opening footage of the film, you know. So it's, like, you almost get this sense of a sort of circular relationship where somebody gets... killed by the cops in custody, that causes riots, and that leads to, you know, this film, which ends with somebody being killed by a cop, you know, like, it kind of, you can see it potentially repeating itself, you know, like, the night after it takes place, after it ends, maybe there's going to be another riot, you know, I don't know.
Well, actually, one of the funny, well, I guess not necessarily funny, but one of the details that I thought was interesting was when they are kicked out of the hospital and they're taken to the precinct, when they walk in, there's a lot of cops actually who are visibly scarred, probably from the last riot. Like, they're just sitting there with, like, ice packs and things like that. So I thought that was an interesting detail. Like, there's always something going on that's probably not good.
Right. Yeah, no, that's funny. Even the actual, like, police brutality, like, on one hand, it's awful, but the way it's directed, it's, like, also a little bit silly I found too, when he's
right.
putting him in the chokehold and the tongues are sticking out. Like,
oh, right,
yeah. I thought that was like a strange way to direct that scene. I don't know if it's
and it didn't
taken
really...
from something true, but
right.
I thought it was a strange choice not to make it 100% serious.
It didn't really seem that bad, even like you know, like the nipple twisting thing, like that.
I mean, I wouldn't want like, it really? To happen to me, but
well, it's not pleasant, but it's not no. what I think of when you say police brutality. So it seemed very mild, actually.
Well, it seems like high school bullying,
right?
You know, these cops come across
well,
like bullies.
And the rooftop as well, kind of earlier in the film when. You would think that there would be a lot more fighting, but then again, I think because of Saeed's brother, who seems to be one of the leaders of that community, as well as the one cop who's there, I think that that's what keeps it from escalating at that point, but you would expect some sort of riot to happen right there.
Right. Again, it's that threat for potential violence that always seems in the air, or, you know, there's people who come into the project seemingly just to provoke. Like I thought it was sort of a funny scene when the Channel 5 crew stops,
right,
and you know they just want a reaction out
right.
of them, and you know when they go to chase them off, like that's basically just the footage that they want,
right? Yeah, that's not good. I mean, that's and all well, I mean, I thought the slide in that scene where it's like a hippo's head with a big
yeah.
tongue is the slide. I thought that was hilarious. And then also
yeah.
the scene with the little kid telling them this story about, what was it? Like some sort of a joke. And they're
yeah,
just sitting
this
there.
This big, long story.
Right. And Saeed keeps throwing rocks at him. Like, and then,
yeah.
well, I'm not doing anything. And then, you know, and this kid is like, you know, what are you doing? You know, and that
he's
kid,
telling the story like he's like 34 years old.
Right.
You know, he's not, he doesn't sound like a kid when he's telling the story.
Yeah. Well, and that was actually one of those things where Kasovic hadn't told the kid that someone would be throwing rocks at him. And then there were a couple of scenes like that where he didn't tell Vincent Cassel like someone was going to slap him in the face. And that's how great Vincent Cassel is. Like he keeps acting through it, but he's genuinely
yeah.
pissed off.
Those moments where you kind of inject some spontaneity into it, and like again when I said the performances have a little bit of a raw quality, I think part of that comes from those sorts of directions where it seems like you know he's trying to provoke responses that are a little bit more real than just you know what an actor might come up with on their own.
Right. Now did you notice the difference in sound? Because I know that he says that in Paris the scenes are, I think, in stereo, and then in the banlieue there, or actually I think the scenes in their neighborhood are in stereo, and then in the city it's in mono, I think, or the other way around. But I didn't really notice anything. So did you notice?
I did notice enough. I mean, I didn't have the best sound system, but I did pick up on some of the differences in the sound design. It's it seems a little bit more quiet when they go into the city and like simpler, you know, there's a little bit more of an elaborate sound design out in the projects. And I think he said he was a little bit inspired by George Lucas's sound design and music choices from American Graffiti, which also I think doesn't have a score. It's just all popular music in the film. So it's similar in that way, but just trying to expand the projects with the sound design, it has like a little bit more built up around it than what you're seeing when you go into the city. I think it's a little bit more naturalistic, you know, you kind of hear what you see. Or maybe not naturalistic, but yeah, simpler. I find, and like even the shooting style in the city, it's simpler, and I think part of that's out of just necessity, because they couldn't bring a bigger crew into the city.
Right.
But it does create like a different feel from the projects, where things are a little bit bigger than life, you know, and they go into the city and it's quieter, it's a little bit more subdued, you know, and that you have these three guys walking around who are very boastful and loud and kind of, you know, acting in big ways, showing off to each other, and they don't quite fit in with that city environment. So I think sometimes just choices like that, or you know, whether or not they were choices, if they were just done out of necessity, kind of create that distinction between the projects in Paris, which is one of the things I like best about the film.
Right. Well, one of the things that I was actually very surprised by is how different the film is when you see it in color, because the deleted scenes are all still in color, and yeah, it looks so different.
It does strike a very different feel. The black and white's really striking. It doesn't look like what you usually expect from a black and white film. Right. Like, it has this look to it, like I don't know, like it should be in a, you know, a magazine spread. It's very high contrast, and it's you know, again, it feels like a little bit more stylized. Like, sometimes the black and white, it's a shorthand for realism. You know, but here, not necessarily. It has, I don't know, like a kind of almost metallic-y look to it, I find.
Right.
Well, like, a lot of the skin tones are very gray. They're kind of grayed out for much of the film.
Well, actually, that's, I was very much reminded of an episode of Community where they made a joke about how when people want you to take something seriously, or they'll take a photo that's in black and white, slightly blurred. And I, right. In a way, it does work, though, because when you see this in color, those few scenes that I think it's 17 minutes worth, and it doesn't have the same impact. And I think partly because when you see it in color, a lot of the clothing dates it very much. And I think you don't get that in black and white. Like, usually technology and clothing and music and certain jokes that are sort of cultural references, those date a film horribly. And I think when you do it in black and white, you don't have that issue as much.
Yeah, I think it's sort of surprising that for a film that feels very specific to a time and place, it also... It's aged very well, I find. It hasn't
right.
Aged poorly, and I think... I don't know, all the music choices I find hold up pretty well too. I was surprised, like, nothing about it feels too dated, you know, too 90s, I guess.
Right. Well, it's definitely very 90s sort of old school rap, but yeah, like, that didn't really date it for me.
No, or like, even the fact that, again, you know, mixing the hip hop with the Edith Piaf, like, right. It's something a little bit old fashioned. You know, you could hear a remix of Edith Piaf today, and like it right. does feel like that contrast between the kind of older, timeless, and something a little bit newer and hip that I think helps give the film a little bit of a, I don't know, timeless quality, I find, surprisingly. And also the fact that it's drawing on a lot of American films from the 70s, right. Like, you know, Kasavitz mentioned Mean Streets is probably his favorite film.
Well, the thing you mentioned about having some sort of old-timey music, just to get back to the Amelie episode, there's mm-hmm. that song in there as well that's very sort of old-fashioned-y, and I'm not sure who sings it, but it does sound like an Edith Piaf song, even though right. I don't think it is, because I think it's a man singing it.
I think so. I'd have to go back and double check, but yeah.
Yeah. But that's, you know, yeah, I always like that song. I think it's the only song that actually is a song, like, not just music, you know, in that mm-hmm. film. And Blade yeah. Runner has the same thing, actually, where they, on that soundtrack, there's one song that sounds like a 1940s kind of song, and it's in there, and I like it very much.
It's interesting, like, how sometimes maybe an older music choice can give a film a more timeless quality than, like, an actual film score. You know, like, sometimes the film scores themselves are the things that age a film most. Like, you know, there was, like, one of the great choices for Space Odyssey 2001 was ditching the score and just using Strauss and, you know, Ligeti and composers like that. Like, you know, instantly kind of takes it out of a time and a place and puts it into something a little bit more timeless and universal. And then when you go back and hear the rejected score, you think, oh, like, that would have dated it so much, you know.
Right.
So, like, you know, a classical film score, you know, it seems almost like a standard for a lot of films, but then you hear in, like, it can instantly drag a film into the 60s or into, you know, whatever right. time period it's written in. So that's kind of a strange quality. You know, films that use classical music, I always think of like Bresson, you know, he has like no score and just at the end having a Beethoven come in or something like that. Like, I find that use of music to always be very effective, you know. And this, even though it's using hip hop, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's like a newer type of music, it's not just throwing on what was popular at the time to, you know, just fill out the spaces. Like, you know, there's a lot of thought that seems to have gone into the sound of this film. Like you said, you know, maybe difference between the stereo and mono depending where they go, or, you know, a lot of the sound choices have some significance, it seems like.
Right. And I also I like the fact that on the commentary you mentioned two hip-hop groups, I think Assassins and MTN, or I think MTN. But actually, Vincent Cassell's brother is one of the members of Assassins.
Nepotism.
Yeah, that's how he got his song in there. That bastard.
Sneaky.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently, they're like a pretty big group over there. Well, and also in I think the rooftop scene, there's probably some music there when mm-hmm. when he steals the sausage, and, you know, yeah. That was actually kind of funny.
Yeah,
everybody keeps talking about his sister as well. That pisses off Saeed very much.
Right.
I do like some of the immature humor in the film. The graffiti as well.
Right.
Yeah, insulting people's moms and, you know, things like that. It's just very teenage type of, you know, humor.
Sure. I mean, sometimes it feels like the punctuation to a joke. A lot of the graffiti, you know, when they get away from the cops, that one scene, and they close
right.
the little porthole behind them, and it has a phrase I probably shouldn't repeat on here, spray painted on. You know, it feels right. like haha, you know, we got away, police, almost the way that piece of graffiti is revealed. You know, there's sort of a joke in it, or like you said, the changing the world is yours into the world is ours, that again feels like a little bit of a, maybe not a joke exactly, but, you know, just a nice detail with the graffiti.
Yeah, and I think one of the deleted scenes actually was a scene where Saeed found the spray can, which he uses later. So that's kind of
right.
funny. But I have to say, one of the pretty interesting things is that, you know, the deleted scenes don't really add anything. And then B, the fact that actually it's a lot shorter than you think it is. Like, this film, when you think of it, it's like, oh, yeah, it's probably like 2 hours or something. It's only 90 minutes.
I think, again, because it has that sort of looser episodic kind of a structure, it feels like a lot happens. A lot does happen, but
right.
It's pretty tight overall, and I think each episode feels self-contained enough, but moves things forward enough that you never really feel bogged down at any point in the film. It's quite light on its feet, and it makes it kind of an easy rewatch. I was surprised. I hadn't seen it in a couple of years either. I think you mentioned you had gone for a couple of years without.
Yeah, I saw it once in, I just checked, 2009, and then I
right.
haven't seen it since. So, and now I've seen it twice in a week.
Same here.
Yeah.
Like, I almost expected it not to hold up as well as it did for some reason. You know, it still feels quite fresh, you know, and I don't know if part of that, again, it's like Kasowitz's later career sort of made me think like, oh, like, is it really going to be that?
You didn't like good, Babylon, you know? AD?
I don't remember Babylon AD, even though I've seen it.
I do like it, but I think it's,
It was like a popcorn flick. It's
yeah, and also yeah. he kept he had a lot of problems with the studio, so a lot of it is just not, you know, he wasn't really able to direct the film that he wanted to, so it suffered from that.
But right, it's even like something Gothica, like a lot of his later films just feel sort of generic, I find, you know. And he had that article a little while ago where he kind of railed against the French film industry for not liking his most recent film, The Rebellion.
Right. Is that any good?
No. Yeah, well, like, I mean, it's not bad, but, like, again, right. I just feel like whatever made Lane special, I'm not sure he's been able to recapture that, and I'm not exactly sure why. I think sometimes, like, I don't know if he was even, like, fluking into certain artistic choices that work really well. Like, we talked about the difference between the cop when he comes into the city, right. when they come into the city.
Right.
You know, but you hear the audio commentary, I don't think he totally gets what makes that detail great. He sort of talks, oh, I just wanted to show that some cops are nice. But the fact that it's there, you know, like, that makes a pretty clear point, I find, that, and like, he didn't seem that aware of it. Or, like, some scenes, you know, he's talking about the scene with the mirror, and
mm-hmm.
like, yeah, it's a great scene, but then he starts going off, like, basically about how great of a director he is. He's like, oh yeah, this shot's so great, I directed this so well, and, like, you know, comes across a little bit arrogant. And, you know, that's not to take away from that scene, like, I think it is, but I sort of wonder, you know, if I, like, maybe the success of Lain kind of took something out of him, or, like, I it's hard to say what exactly made his later career the way that it is. You know, he had that Assassins film that followed it up that wasn't very good. You know, like, a lot of his films since just don't seem to have that same specificity and boldness and, you know, even feeling of reality.
What did you think of the, you saw the behind the scenes documentary as well, right? The 10 years right. after, okay. What did you think of that annoying thing of, like, oh, you know, we don't want to attend the Césars, and we're not making, oh, you know, you can't grade art, so, man.
So full of themselves, yes. I know.
Him and Vincent Cassel, man. I hate that nonsense.
I mean, they're talented, but, like, it's...
And I love Vincent Cassel.
It's frustrating whenever you hear people with... I know, Vincent Cassel, he's excellent, excellent actor, but I...
It was like when Eddie Vedder went to pick up a Grammy, I think it was, and he's like, I don't know what this means, man. And, you know, it's just so annoying. It's just like, well, then, you know, what are you doing? Like, it's just something nice, and, you know, it just means that people, like, you know, it just means that people liked what you did, and, you know, you don't have yeah. to participate in all the lobbying that goes into it. You know, just let the work speak for itself, and if people like it, then, you know, you come and you pick up the thing, and that's that. Like, why do you have to be a, you know...
Maybe if you had, like, one more film like Lain, you could be that arrogant. I don't know, but, like, as it starts to look more and more almost like a fluke that the further on he goes.
Right.
Like, I think... Lain was actually his second film, right?
Yeah, I know he directed because the gymnasium where that boxing match is, that's where he shot his first short, which is about this. He actually starred in that as well. I think it's called Fierro Le Fou, I think, something like that. And he okay. He plays this shy basketball player. I think it's like a 10-minute thing, and I think he also directed one movie before this, so he hadn't done a ton of work yet. But
Café au Lait, yeah, because he mentions right. that he had already worked with Hubert
right.
Koundé and
well, they had didn't
Vincent Cassel, yeah,
right, because didn't he have a bit of a falling out? Like, I got the sense that him and Hubert didn't like each other anymore because Hubert did go to the Césars to pick up the award. I think that was
that's a stupid thing to have a falling out over.
I know, but... yeah, but I got the sense that they didn't really get along anymore these days, but.
I don't think they worked together since. And he said when he started working on Lain, there were people saying that he should play the Vince character. Which
really?
that's what he said. Which, I can't think how that might have changed the film. And I don't know how Vincent Cassel would have felt if Kasovitz played a character based on him.
Right.
what that would be like. But
I don't think he would have been very good. To be honest with you, like,
he seems too nice. I mean, I was just talking about how arrogant he can come across, but he has that sort of, like, smiley face. That,
well, he also looks a lot older than them.
So yeah, I think weird. He's a little bit older than them. Yeah, they would have been weird. I'm glad the casting worked out the way it did.
Yeah,
that's one of the strongest things about the film is just the cast overall, especially the three leads. So I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to mention, or if we covered...
I think Oh, well, yeah, the one thing that I thought was funny about Saeed is that he keeps asking, you know, how did they get the car in there? You know, he's so fascinated with the car in the youth center. He can't figure it out.
It's smaller than the door. I mean, sometimes you see stuff like that, like after Riot, you sort of wonder, like, how did that get on top of that? Or, people go a little bit wild, or definitely go wild. Like, in the film, they talk about them basically burning.
Well, there's the
guy who's complaining
cars.
About his cars being burned. Right. Yeah, there's sort of this, I don't know what you'd say, like fish out of water motif, like, you know, cow in the projects, car should be, you know, these three guys in Paris who sort of don't fit in there. Like, there is that kind of motif running through it, I guess.
Well, the one thing I do want to mention, last thing, is that the guy in the photo, the Abdel character, that was actually a real guy, and he was he talks about it in the commentary that his girlfriend had been harassed by some cops, so he went to the precinct and kind of told them off, and then later on they found him and they set him on fire. Which was insane. Like, what is that? Like, I don't even... Like, how do you get to that place? It's just such, you know,
which,
hate.
I know, that's... I feel strange about that, like, somebody using a real person like that in a film as a character, but...
Well, I suppose you have to get these photos from somewhere, you know? And like, one of those things that always kind of takes me out of a movie is when you see the characters in those fake family photos, and it looks so photoshopped. And, you know, so I'd rather have this than, you know...
Sure, but, I mean, it's a character you never see on screen. You think they could have, you know, photographed one of their friends or, you know, could have been.
Well, he was,
like that,
didn't he live in the neighborhood where it was shot? I think that he was just some guy who lived around there. So I think that they probably got permission from him.
I'm sure they got permission. It's just, you know, sort of a surprisingly weighty choice, you know.
Right.
I think you probably did it, I think, to try to have that extra impact and, you know, give the film some of that extra weight.
Right.
Hui.
Yeah. Well, I think we did it.
I think so. I hope we covered all the bases. It's
I like that.
It's a good film to jump into.
Yeah, I like that we went all over the place. It kind of feels, you know, in keeping with, you know, with the style of the film, and, you know,
I'll just blame my scattered nature on that. So where can folks find you on the internet, or is there anything you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm on Twitter, at Matt, 2 T's, R says, and then I also write for a Film Inquiry, and there's a link for that in my Twitter bio, so you can find sort of articles about movie trailers, and that's usually the stuff I write about. I don't necessarily want to write giant essays about movies or something, but this is, you know, a fun way to keep it short and sweet, and that way I can, you know, kind of let people know about stuff that I'm excited to, you know, see. So, Also, I noticed there's a Predator on your bookshelf there. I really like it. Very cool.
I don't know if listeners know. I don't know if I actually ever brought it up on FlixWise, but I think Predator 2 is one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
Which...
Well, you wrote an article, I think, in defense of Predator 2. Wasn't that your article?
Yeah, on the Film 89 website. Yeah, that was mine.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that film, too. And actually, when is the new one coming out? Because I know there was a trailer out for it already a while back. But is that this summer somewhere?
I think it's supposed to be, like, late this summer. I'm a little bit skeptical of the new one. I don't know. I love the first two a lot, especially the second one, but... I don't, like, some of the more recent ones, like, there was the Robert Rodriguez one. I was like, I don't know about this.
Okay,
I'm not as into it.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Maybe I'll be eating my words in a couple weeks' time, so.
Well, let's hope so.
Let's hope so. Well, that took an interesting turn for the show. Thanks for coming on. And
yeah,
if folks want to follow the show, it's at FlixWise on Twitter, and you can rate and review on iTunes, and you know, don't show us hate, show us love. l'amour, I guess.
Right.
Thank you. Take care.